The Jason Rance Show.
Jason Rance hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rance, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rance, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
We will take you through the trial in Idaho with Brian Kohlberger, the individual who was accused of a quadruple homicide. He stayed silent yesterday when asked for his plea. What does that mean? Ann Bremner will explain. Paul Clark is a Bellevue City Council candidate. He says he keeps hearing the same thing over and over and over again when he's knocking on doors. Folks are concerned that Bellevue could become Seattle. So what's the plan to stop that? He'll explain. Plus, the death of AM radio, is it imminent? With some car manufacturers saying, we're not going to include them on your radios. We're going to discuss this hour on The Jason Rance Show. So let's dive in.
The monologue.
Over the course of the last 24 hours or so, Seattle had its 26th and 27th suspected homicide. Both of them happened overnight, within an hour of each other. And not a single person in a position of leadership that I've heard is sounding the alarms. Even though we're on pace to meet or exceed last year's 57 homicides. And that's before the summer, which is important because in summer, we always see a surge in crime, particularly violent crime. There have been studies and papers written on this. It's not just in Seattle, it's across the country. In summer, we see crime go up. Depending on where you live, it might be certain kinds of crime, but that's what we generally see. And when we're already at 27, and it's not even at that halfway point, and last year was 57, the year before that, what was it, 59? 61, something like that, a record high? Yeah, things are not trending in the right direction when it comes to violent crime in Seattle. And it feels like this is the new norm. I was on this morning on the Faulkner Focus on Fox News. And we were talking about crime in LA and Chicago. And I was asked to react to two videos showing just two separate mobs of people. One over 100 children again getting into a fight. That was in Chicago. Then bikers in Los Angeles just beating the heck out of someone. And I made the point that I guess the video is shocking, right? Because when you see someone getting beat up or multiple people getting seriously injured, the human part of all of us, we are repulsed, we're disgusted, we're maybe anxious or scared. But we look at it and obviously we have a negative reaction. But I pointed out to Harris, I'm not shocked by this. And I don't think really anyone should be shocked by crime that's happening in Democrat-run cities. You create a snowball. There's a snowball effect with crime. Violence begets violence. Gunshots beget more gunshots. Murder begets more murder. Stolen cars beget more stolen cars when you don't get in the way. And when you've created a culture of lawlessness where people know that they can get away with all sorts of things, well, they're not only going to try to get away with it, but they're going to escalate their crimes. And then you get to the point where you have the 26th and 27th homicide in a city like Seattle that's not used to this kind of homicide rate. And no one says anything because it's the new norm, because no one's shocked. Now, the first shooting happened early this morning, about 2 a.m. It happened in the Ravenna neighborhood of Seattle by a park called Olga Park. Cops found a man with a fatal gunshot wound. They tried to save him. He's 46 years old, but unfortunately, he died at the scene. SPD Detective Judina Gulpin spoke with our sister station, Cairo News Radio, during a press briefing, and they believe this was targeted.
It does not appear to be random, but again, still collecting information about potential suspects and others that may have been involved.
Now, an hour later, so about 3 a.m., officers found a man with head injuries and a gunshot wound. This was near downtown Seattle. Unfortunately, the victim, 29 years old, he ends up dying as well. The detective explained what they saw when they got there.
Police and Seattle Fire did respond, like I said, to the scene. But unfortunately, the 29-year-old man had already succumbed to his injuries. at the location where they found him.
Is that surprising? Are these two stories surprising? Be honest. When we hear of a juvenile getting shot in Tacoma, are we surprised? When we hear of a car break-in in Tukwila, are we surprised? When we hear about gun violence in Yakima, are we surprised? Of course not. Because that's where we're at, and no one seems to be paying attention. Not in positions of power in the Democrat-run areas. This is not inherently a political issue. It is not a right versus left issue. I don't think so. But it's become that because this is all a result of policy, and the silence is coming from one political party. There's no Republicans in positions of power that matter when it comes to violent crime in Seattle. You've got a Seattle city attorney who deals with misdemeanors. And I was going to say Ann Bremner. Ann Davison, who is doing what she can, but she doesn't deal with violent crime. We have a mayor. We have a council. They're not saying anything. We have an SPD that is dealing with a severely depleted staff. They just put out new data today. They said their goal by this part of 2023 was to hire 31 officers. They only hired 26. While at the same time, they continue to lose police officers. Now, at best, and they're not going to hit this, but they're guessing that they'll hire 115 officers by the end of the year, but lose 106. That's not a pickup of very many. Especially because they need to hire, not lose. They can't afford to lose any. They need to hire somewhere between 500 and 600 cops to get to their goal. So they're not even at 10. They couldn't even get to 10 hires, they're predicting, by the end of the year. And by the way, I still think that that's wrong. Unfortunately, I think we're going to continue to lose more cops than we bring in. I hope I'm wrong. I do. But that's the reality we now find ourselves in. And again, no one is sounding the alarms. Republicans are, but no one in a position of power on the left, no one is sounding the alarms.
The interview.
Brian Kohlberg is accused of a quadruple homicide over at the University of Idaho. It is a crime that is getting a whole lot of attention, not just regionally, but nationwide. Yesterday, in front of a judge, according to his lawyer, he will be standing silent on pleas. What exactly does that mean? Joining me on the line to help us understand what's going on is the author of Justice in the Age of Judgment. She's a defense attorney, Ann Bremner. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on with you, Jason.
So judge says, how do you plead? The lawyer says he will be standing silent. What does that mean?
It doesn't mean a whole lot. I mean, the judge then entered a plea of not guilty for him. And that's what usually happens if somebody waives reading of that indictment or information. And ask the court to enter a plea, the lawyer may say, can the court enter a plea on behalf of my client of not guilty? But what he did, you know, is so unusual. It happened once, I think, in the school slayings in Florida with that defendant. But you don't see it very often. I think he was just trying to make some kind of a statement of, you know, being defiant, but also in control and making news. He's been watching all of his own coverage, I understand. He's very obsessed with himself and his coverage in this terrible, terrible, terrible crime.
Is it possible that there is a strategic legal move behind this?
Some have said that it would be a basis to challenge the grand jury indictment. I don't really agree, but it may be the strategy here. Another strategy could simply be that he's trying to appease the victim families by not formally entering a plea or stating it. The plea himself in court. I've heard that stated by experts too. I don't know if I agree with that either, because I think the only appeasement of the victims would be, of the families would be, if he pled guilty.
Yeah.
You know, and told them what happened. So those could be the strategies, Jason, but I just, you know, to me, he wanted to make an impression. I'm not sure that it was a good one.
Well, let me throw at you one theory that actually Nancy Grace posited last night. She made a point that there is a witness in this case or someone who was in the house who heard Brian Kohlberg allegedly speak.
Yes.
Is it possible the reason why he's not speaking is he doesn't want to make it easier for his voice to be recognized as the voice in the home?
Yeah. You know, I think Nancy Grace is great. She's been a good friend to me for many years. I think that's a good point. However, he did speak when the judge asked if he understood the charges with the four murder counts. So he did speak. Mm-hmm. It wasn't not guilty, but he did say yes on four at least four occasions. And that might be enough for voice identification.
What does the evidence look like to you? If you're the defense attorney here, are you sweating and saying, okay, Brian, you're going to need to take a plea deal?
Yeah, I'd be really sweating. This is a terrible case. I mean, they've got all kinds of evidence we heard from the get-go in those search warrant affidavits and PC statements. And that's, you know, interestingly, in Idaho, they don't have the insanity defense in Idaho. It's been abolished. He's facing the death penalty, and he qualifies. And it's death by a firing squad, potentially, in Idaho, just like Oklahoma, I think South Carolina, Alabama, and, of course, Utah, where the Gary Gilmore case was. So I don't. They're not going to plea bargain for the death penalty. I know that happened here with the Green River Killer years ago because he gave information about, you know, victims' locations. But usually a prosecutor will say, I'm not going to plea bargain for the death penalty. If I'm his lawyer, I'm thinking this is going to be a tough row to hoe. I mean, there's so much publicity about him. It's such a terrible, terrible case, and there's so much evidence. And it's a death case.
You've got a book out. It's called Justice in the Age of Judgment. And you cover Amanda Knox, O.J. Simpson, Kyle Rittenhouse. And the basic point is that because of the media and public scrutiny of some of these higher profile cases, for whatever reason, they become high profile. It makes it more difficult to get a fair trial in the sense that you're not necessarily seen as innocent until proven guilty from the media or the public. How much of that impacts the court? So when you look at the Kohlberg case, can he truly get a fair trial given the coverage?
No, I don't think he can. And, you know, I just defended Sheriff Troyer, as you know, mm-hmm. and thank you for, you know, your interviews on that case. And that case really, I mean, had so much publicity. It was really hard to get a fair trial. Luckily, he had a great jury, great judge, and he was acquitted as he should have been. But, it's so difficult to get a fair trial. All the judge can do is what the judge is doing here. Issue a gag order, make sure there's no more leaks, make sure that there's an untainted jury, take your time picking a jury like we did in the Troyer case, Sheriff Troyer case, where you find some folks that can really judge the evidence based on what they hear in a courtroom and nothing else.
Why did you decide to take that particular angle with the book?
Because I've lived it so many times. I cover cases, of course, as an analyst, and then I've had the Sheriff Troyer case. We had the Susan Cox Powell Cox versus State case where the boys, mm-hmm. of course, were killed against the state of Washington. I've had the Mary Cable Turnow civil case. And then I've covered all these other cases over the last 20 years. And so I just saw it over and over and over again. And, of course, Amanda Knox. That was the first international internet case. And everything shifted in her case. You know, there was no evidence in that case whatsoever against her. She stayed in prison for 4 years. You know, the litigation criminal in that case went on, off and on, for almost a decade. And I saw it firsthand that that's exactly the kind of problem we have these days, because the court system, it's just not catching up with what we see on the internet, social media, and media. And you got to really work hard as a defense lawyer to counter that.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, that's really what it's about. I mean, you have the Kyle Rittenhouse case. I think the media, 90% of them were against Kyle Rittenhouse. They determined he was a white supremacist and a murderer, and yet somehow he was
right.
able to, you know, overcome all the bias. And so maybe there isn't the grip on court cases as much as we think, or maybe it has the opposite effect, where if everyone's
exactly.
saying, right, like if everyone's
right.
saying you're guilty, maybe you're on the jury saying, you don't get to tell me how to decide here. I'll push back against that. And maybe that makes them a little bit more open-minded. I don't know. It's a fascinating topic. I hope people will check out the book. It's called Justice in the Age of Judgment, from Amanda Knox to Kyle Rittenhouse and the Battle for Due Process in the Digital Age. Ann Bremner, thank you so much for stopping by.
It's such a pleasure. Thanks, Jason.
Now this.
The Interview.
Whenever you're running for a city council position outside of the city of Seattle, the question becomes, what can we do to avoid becoming Seattle? And a lot of the issues that have come up from a voter perspective in the city of Seattle seem to be coming up from a voter perspective in the city of Bellevue, where our next guest, Paul Clark, is running for city council. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you, Jason.
So you've been knocking on doors for a few months now. What are you hearing?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I think my team is up to about 7,800 voters that we've contacted at the door. I've done over 2,000 myself. And what you just started off the interview with is exactly what I'm hearing the most, which is whatever kinds of things that are going on in Seattle that we see on the news, we really don't want to see those start to take root in Bellevue. And they want to see the continuation of policies like compassion enforcement and fully getting towards fully staffing the police department, mm-hmm. which we're not there yet. They want to see us move in that direction to ensure that Bellevue stays Bellevue.
Yeah, a lot of this, it seems, is a mix of being proactive and addressing issues that are starting to pop up. And I think one of the, like policing, to your point, SPD, Seattle Police Department, is understaffed. Bellevue is understaffed. The crime crisis is different in both cities. You guys don't have necessarily a violent crime problem, but you've been seeing an uptick in burglaries, the lower level theft crimes that cause a lot of issues for folks, especially if you're a business owner.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've got things on the retail side. We've got everything from low-level organized crime that's occurring in our retail sectors downtown, as well as just out in the neighborhood. The number of times I've seen a jimmied mailbox is countless at this point, and voters at the door are frustrated by that, frustrated about the car prowls. And it definitely, yeah, there's a mixture of things, but definitely in Bellevue, we're ahead of that. We need some help at the state level.
Sure.
The pursuit bill was frustrating. The things that we have seen as a state, the fact that we've seen 31% more car theft this year, that we're third in the nation, ahead of many more populous states than we are, and this car theft bill being, and I'm not trying to focus on the state issue so much, except my opponent unfortunately made some concerning comments yesterday in council about the pursuit bill as being some kind of reasonable compromise that they came to, as opposed to what it really is, which is a bad bill based on bad data that is creating property crime issues across the state.
Yeah, and their compromise does not address a single bit of the concerns from folks in Bellevue when it comes to crime. No, you know, allowing cops now to pursue for violent felonies without using probable cause, that really was not an issue. It was the ability to commit a nonviolent crime and then not be able to be chased or not to be able to chase them. That's the issue.
Right.
What do you think John Stokes doesn't get it?
You know, I don't want to opine on what's going on in his head. I really want to focus more on his actions. I do think that his actions and his words really illustrate somebody who's out of touch with the electorate in Bellevue, out of touch with the voters and the residents of the city. I mean, I saw that just to move to another topic I'm hearing a lot about at the door, the middle housing bill. I think reasonable people can disagree on how growth and density should happen in a city like Bellevue. I've said publicly that I think the growth should be primarily in our growth corridors, that we should build dense and high in places designed for it. Out in the suburbs, I think protecting the single family neighborhoods makes sense. Just to kind of illustrate some of the differences, though, my opponent back in February of this year, February 28th, feel free to look it up. I mean, rather than just simply disagree with that position, he really characterized the views of constituents concerned about this. And I'm just going to quote directly. He said a lot of people like to keep their bubble and be back then. He also said people don't like change. They're happy when they have their little space. I mean, I just think these are comments of somebody who has not really been out in the community and has lost touch with where voters are at. And I don't think that kind of disparagement and contempt of legitimate voters' concerns is what we need on the council.
You are running, though, against someone who's got some name recognition, certainly for the folks who've previously voted for him. He's previously been the mayor of the city of Bellevue. This is a guy who I imagine is going to say, hey, y'all have liked living in Bellevue. You've seen the growth that we've had here over the course of the last several years, all thanks to, you know, the incompetence of Seattle. Why would you, you know, switch at this point and go to someone who hasn't been tested the way I have been tested, who doesn't have the experience that I have? So what is the argument against that?
Yeah, I think the argument is that on the issues I'm hearing about at the door, I'm just stronger. People are concerned about crime. They're concerned about the indiscriminate upzoning, and they're concerned about property taxes. And on each one of those issues, I am more in line with the electorate. And I think, in addition to that, I think it's really just time for a change. People are, I think, tired of career politicians who don't move on. He's served three terms. He's attempting to serve a fourth. I think that there's a value in a city that is so dependent on technology to have a small business tech entrepreneur like myself representing that community on council. And I think it's time. And I think that the record is clear that we need to move on.
It's time for some new blood. That's Paul Clark. He's running for city council in Bellevue. It's number one. It's position number one. He's running against an incumbent, and he would like your vote. His website to learn more, clarkforbellevue.com. It's all spelled out. clarkforbellevue.com. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much, Jason.
You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing us these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
When it comes to getting after the drug crisis, one that is absolutely killing scores of folks who we could help, it's all about getting them treatment. It's making sure that they see some kind of relief to the underlying condition that's leading them to crime, leading them to a life of homelessness. It's that drug addiction. Joining me on the line is a lawmaker who has helped make that a reality in certain circumstances. Joining me on the line, State Senator Chris Gildon, the Republican from Puyallup. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me again.
So you've got a bill. Somehow you got it to get signed into law at a time where the legislative session was very hostile, it seems, to Republican bills. Take us through 5502.
Well, so 5502 deals with persons who are being released out of the Department of Corrections custody into the community early, so before that their sentence is fully committed. A few years ago, the legislature enacted the program called graduated reentry that allows them to do a portion of the end of their sentence in a community setting. And the Department of Corrections also sends out a report every time that someone under their custody passes away. And I read every one of those. And what I've noticed was a bit of a pattern over the year is I noticed that there were a number of people who were going to this graduated reentry program who had not received any type of substance use disorder treatment. And then they passed away within just a short time after being released into the community from drug overdose. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, we've got to do something about that because people are dying. And so this particular bill does a number of things. Number one is it requires the Department of Corrections to do an assessment for everyone being released to see if they have a drug disorder. And it requires the Department of Corrections to help get them into appropriate treatment if they do have a disorder. And then it also requires some reporting requirements and some other things. But the bottom line is what it really tries to do is to help people who are releasing early, because whenever they're in prison, supposedly, ideally, they're not using drugs.
Well,
and then a lot of them, they release back into the community and they start using again at the level that they previously used at, and their tolerance is low and they're dying of overdose.
Yeah.
And so we're really trying to prevent that.
Well, the thing is, a lot of prisoners are gaining access to drugs still. They're being smuggled in. You had an incident just last week where seven inmates over in Snohomish County ended up being sent to the hospital with suspected overdose. We've seen similar circumstances across the state. I know Whatcom County about a month and a half ago or so. And so, you know, when you're not getting these people the treatment that they need just because they're in jail doesn't mean they're going to just simply detox, then move on. It's not that simple.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I don't think that this particular bill is perfect. I'm really glad that it passed, and I think it's going to make a big difference. Not only in preventing people from overdosing, but also in preventing them from, you know, returning back to a life of crime to feed their drug habit, which is what we don't want. We want to get ahead of that. But ideally, we could get to a place where the Department of Corrections would start that rehabilitative programming on day one when the person is entered into custody. I think that would be ideal. But we're not there yet.
We're not there yet. Why aren't we there?
Well, I think some of it has to do with cost. I think some of it has to do with
ideology,
just the ideology. And I think those are probably the two main barriers. You know, if I were king for a day, I would make rehabilitation job one of the Department of Corrections so that people, while they're in prison, while they're in the custody of the state, they get all of the knowledge, the skills, and the abilities that they need for success when they eventually release back into the community, because we don't want them to recidivate. We don't want them to return to a life of crime. But we know right now that an overwhelming majority of them do.
They do. Why do you think there seems to be – I mean, it seems that the policy now coming from some folks on the left, certainly it seems like a majority of – Washington Democrats who are serving, that they would rather just release criminals from jail or keep them out rather than rehabilitate them while they're incarcerated. Why do you think there's that shift? Or am I crazy? That's what it seems like.
No, and I think it goes a little further than that, Jason. I think that there are a number of legislators who feel that putting people in jail is immoral, it's wrong, that it's not something that society should do, that we should focus all of our efforts on rehabilitation and zero of our efforts on incarceration. So there are some ideological, you know, differences that we have with certain members of the legislature. But I kind of personally think that we've got to have that balance of, yes, if you've committed a crime and you've been convicted and you've been sentenced, there's a penalty that you need to pay. But while you're in the state's custody, I think the state has a responsibility to ensure that you have some of the skills and the knowledge that you need so that you don't return to a life of crime when you're eventually released.
Yeah, and this has nothing necessarily to do, or at least not exclusively about drug use, right? I mean, this is just in a general sense that, you know, you're being put in jail. We know that being put in jail once you're released, your life is going to be a little bit more difficult getting on the right track. It is harder to get a job. It is harder to find housing. That's part of the consequences of, you know, violating our societal rules and harming other people. But we don't have to make it harder on these folks. We can make it easier by giving them access to, you know, whatever program they might need in order to better their lives, right? I mean, we have an ethical obligation. If we're going to punish people and they do want to get better, whether that means drug addiction or literally anything else, I think it's on us to help.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was really happy to get some money allocated in the budget for the Washington State Institute of Public Policy to do, number one, to take an inventory of all of the rehabilitative programs that are available in our prisons. And then number two, do a study to see which ones actually have an effect at reducing recidivism. So the idea is, number one, we get the inventory so we know what programs are actually being offered. Number two, we see which ones are most effective, which ones are least effective. And then later, once we get the results of the study back, we can funnel dollars to the programs that work and not send dollars to the programs that don't work.
State Senator Chris Gildon joining me on the line, Republican from Puyallup. As it relates back to the drug issue, the drug bill that criminalizes drug possession, drug use, I spoke last week with State Representative Jim Walsh of Aberdeen. he doesn't think the bill goes far enough. He's not necessarily a fan of it. It's better than nothing, obviously. But what say you? Are you in the camp of this was the best we can do, let's live with it for now? Or are you in the camp of we really dropped the ball on this and didn't go far enough?
No, well, it's amazing how bills change throughout the legislative process. So the bill that I originally submitted said that the Department of Corrections could not release anyone until they were enrolled in services if they had a substance use disorder. That was a little too far for the majority party to go with. And so this is where we landed. I think it's better than nothing. I don't think it's perfect. And like I said, I really think that all of these programming, these rehabilitative programs, should start from day one of incarceration. And we should not be waiting until they're being released into the community to begin those programs of rehabilitation.
Did the Democrats tell you why that was too much, too far, I guess, to the right, even though I don't think that this is seen by virtually anyone as a political issue?
No, and I think it just goes back to what we said a moment ago, that there are certain people with ideological differences. They don't want to send additional dollars to the Department of Corrections for programming or for any other purpose because they would prefer to basically shut down the Department of Corrections and not incarcerate anyone.
Well, this is the defund movement, which they're doing it in a different way, right? I mean, they're just going the abolitionist route. They can claim that they don't hold those views, but I think it's pretty clear when you take away programs that actually help people or prevent dollars to go there because you want to see the DOC basically be shut down, when you, rather than, you know, cut funding to police, you just cut their responsibilities, the end result is virtually the same.
Yeah, sure. Well, I've always said, you know, there's basically three links in the chain of criminal justice. Is one, you've got the police officers who enforce the law. We've seen numerous attempts to try to handcuff the police and limit their ability to do their jobs. Next, you've got the prosecutors in the courts who, you know, determine guilt or innocence and determine sentences. But then you've got the Department of Corrections, which houses prisoners. And we've seen through programs like the graduated reentry programs and others where there's a real push to reduce the sentences for criminal behavior. And so what you're seeing is a push on all fronts from those people who, you know, prefer zero incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to reduce penalties at all stages of that chain.
It's absolute madness. I mean, it really is madness. Last question for you. What is the plan going into the next legislative session? Obviously, we don't know what the political atmosphere will be like. You certainly have agenda items, but when you're so outmanned as far as just the numbers in the Senate and the House, what is the plan?
Well, we'll see where we land. I think that we ended this legislative session with a few good successes. You know, in the Senate, we were able to bring up the police pursuit bill and actually keep that alive. Like we said, you know, it was a half step forward, but it was necessary. We were able to keep the Blake bill with drug possession alive and actually come out with a bipartisan solution, which everybody is not in love with, but at least it's something that's workable, that doesn't allow drugs to be just legal in our state. So I think we're coming out of this legislative session with a few successes, along with 5502, which I passed. And so we'll see where we go this next legislative session. It seems like perhaps some of those more extreme left-wing voices are being drowned out by people with a little bit more sense, I think. And we'll see if that continues through the next session or not.
Well, let's hope they continue to be not just drowned out, but then eventually booted from office. We've been talking with State Senator Chris Gildon of Puyallup. Thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Jason.
You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
There is an existential threat to AM radio. One that, depending on who you ask, is driven by ideology or is driven by technology and electric vehicles and what is necessary to keep them going with minimal interference. Regardless, the end result is exactly the same, that as new cars are removing AM radios from their vehicles, or new car dealers manufacturers are removing it from their new models, radio on the AM dial is in deep trouble. And as you know, of course, conservative radio is incredibly powerful. We're able to move the needle on important issues. We're able to get folks truly aware of what's going on in a way that they're not getting from television or newspapers, because ultimately, almost regardless of where it is you live, there's going to be a liberal slant, or it's just going to be flat out far left propaganda that we're supposed to pretend is news. Sorry, that's the unfortunate reality. And with AM radio going away, there are a lot of folks right now sounding the alarms. There's a story in The Hill that says your next car might be missing a button, the one to switch between AM and FM. Car manufacturers are increasingly opting to eliminate AM radio in their new vehicles. BMW, Mazda, Volvo, Volkswagen, Tesla are either already removing AM from their cars, or they plan to do it in some of the electric models moving forward. When you look at, according to Detroit Free Press, they say Ford is going even further, getting rid of them in all of their new cars, gas or electric. Now, part of it is due to the electromagnetic interference. That's at least what the car manufacturers are telling all of us, that electric motors can interfere with AM radio frequencies, which would make it sound staticky. For those of you who would be listening, the Free Press printed a statement from Ford that said it's also just changing with the times. They say a majority of U.S. AM stations, as well as a number of countries and automakers globally, are modernizing radio by offering internet streaming through mobile apps, FM, digital, and satellite radio options. And that's absolutely true. We have a KTTH smartphone app, right? You can get it on your iPhone, on your Android phone, and that's how I listen. And AM radio can survive if the audience is willing to download an app and then use the app to either send it via Bluetooth to their speakers in their car, or depending on the model, you can end up downloading apps on the car dashboard itself. And that would be basically the equivalent of having an AM radio. But there are folks like Mark Levin, who's on this station, who is pointing out on Fox News, this is more of an attack on conservative talk radio than anything else.
They finally figured out how to attack conservative talk radio, Mr. Producer. Let me be the first one to say it. Right at the manufacturer level, rather than going after us through the FCC, rather than going after us through legislation, rather than going after us through boycotting advertisers and all the rest, just don't make AM stations available in automobiles anymore. Because not all, but most conservative talk shows are on the AM band.
It's true. Now, there are some of us who are also on the FM band. So, for example, you can pick up the show right now. If you have an HD radio, we're on 97.3 FM, channel 3. Now, I don't know how many people have HD radios, but that's one way to listen to us on the FM dial. If you're listening right now in, you know, Bellevue and Mercer Island into Kirkland, you can listen to 94.5 FM. We are on a translator there. So there are different ways to get us, but I do worry about what the future holds. I don't think this poses an imminent threat, like within the next 5 years or so. But while Democrats in positions of power are pushing you into getting EVs, forcing you into purchasing EVs if you want to purchase a car, that is a huge threat for us. Now, Hugh Hewitt, who is a talk show host who has been around for a while, he does syndicated radio, he doesn't seem to think that AM radios are going to go anywhere, certainly not in the near or distant future. He was on Fox News.
There are a lot of small urban churches,
sure.
For example, the Black Church, the Hispanic Church, that depend upon it. A lot of the language-only stations, like Korean language station and Afghan language station in the Bay Area. All the AM radio does is provide the ability for everyone with an ability to get to one small station a voice to grow.
And so for the folks who, you know, decry any kind of corporation, taking over media. He's basically saying you'd be killing a lot of small radio stations that are there purely for the community. And by the way, AM radio is vital if there's ever, God forbid, an emergency.
Congress is going to say to the automakers, if you want the subsidies, you're going to make sure that we can use the EBS, because in everybody's earthquake kick, I've lived in California most of my adult life, everybody's earthquake kit has a transistor radio that is powered by a battery right. and a crank. And that's because that's how you communicate when tornadoes hit, when earthquakes hit, when there's any kind of a threat. Getting rid of AM radio is really a stupid move. And I expect these right. car companies to find out that if the customer doesn't say no on the lot, Congress is going to say no on the Capitol.
Right. I wish I was as optimistic as he is, but I clearly am not. I think that this is a significant threat. That's why I've spent a lot of my time promoting our digital elements. And so the one thing you can do right now is download the KTTH app. That's the one thing you can do right now that helps all of us sleep at night, wondering if people are actually going to adopt the digital technologies. So go to your app store on your phone. You can even text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. I'll send you a link. It'll have a link to the app. It's important that you download the app. Beyond that, it's important that we understand the power of radio and what we will lose out on if we do allow this to happen. So number two, what you can do is make sure you're writing to your member of Congress. Now, if you are in a Republican district, so if you're listening to me right now on the east side of the state, if you're listening in, Dan Newhouse's district or Kathy McMorris Rogers, you're fine. But if right now you're listening in a district run by Pramila Jayapal, we're not going to be able to count on her. So make the argument that they're hurting. Make the woke argument. Tell them that they're hurting Black-owned, Latino-owned businesses that play a vital role in getting information out to the community. So if you are living in a congressional district with a Democrat, which is going to be the vast majority of you listening right now, make sure you are emailing and calling them and politely telling them that they need to step up and preserve AM radio. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. Don't forget, download the KTTH smartphone app. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.